Hey everyone, thanks for listening to my podcasts here on the Hullerstubber feed. Do spread the word to other people if you think they might enjoy them. Do listen to some more if you think you might enjoy them, but do enjoy this one. I am shortly going to be on tour with my new stand-up show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Head to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all those dates. Some of them are sold out, some of them have hardly sold anything. It would really help me if you bought tickets to the ones that aren't sold out. Either way, as soon as you can. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. It's about cancer and testicles. One of them's not funny, but one of them's really funny, and it kind of cancels out the unfunniness. I'd say just on average, slightly more funny. So I hope you'll come along. If not, keep enjoying the podcast. We'll be back in September at the Leicester Square Theatre with more live podcasts. Maybe a few Edinburgh ones before then. Sit back, relax, and enjoy this stupid podcast you've chosen to listen to.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Welcome to yet another Hullerstubber Book Club. I'm delighted to be joined by Stephanie Merritt, who is going to be telling us about her fantastic novel, Storm. Hello, Stephanie.
Hello. How are you?
How are you?
Oh, I'm good.
I'm good too. Let's talk in unison all the time for the rest of the podcast. That will be fun. For people who don't know who you are, I know a little bit about you, but who are you, Stephanie Merritt? Tell me a bit about yourself.
Is that what, on an existential level?
It can be. You can take it out.
Well, I am a journalist and author. I write for The Observer. I used to work on their books pages. I used to be the deputy literary editor on The Observer for many years, and I was also their comedy critic, which is how you and I met many years ago. And I then, I was writing novels as well, kind of while doing that. And then about, when was it? 2008, I started writing a historical thriller series, which meant that I could give up the day job. So I still do little bits of journalism and reviewing here and there, but I'm mostly writing full time now. So I wrote this historical series under a pseudonym, S.J. Paris, and then I also do contemporary thrillers under my own name, which is what the most recent one is.
So that's... And what's the thinking behind having a pseudonym for the historical stuff? Is there a reason for that, or is it just good fun?
No, there is a reason, and it really is as basic as marketing. Before I started doing those, I had written 3 books under my own name, and they were quite different types of books. And I was also writing as a journalist under my own name. And so to launch the series, it's often in publishing, it can just be a bit easier if you're completely changing direction. Yeah. Sometimes to launch you almost as an entirely new author. So that's what we did. And the pseudonym is, it's more of it's obviously gender neutral. So we hoped that the series would kind of appeal, have a broader appeal than perhaps one written, that was obviously under a woman's name. It's also enabled me to have kind of 2 different strands of my writing. So I can do these. So when people pick up an S.J. Paris novel, they know that it's going to be one of these historical thrillers. And sure.
That's a shame, though, isn't it? It's weird that in this day and age that's still... Does that mean you think the Stephanie Merritt novels are more aimed at women, or is you don't, it doesn't matter for these ones? Well, it's sort of weird that it matters.
I'd like to think it doesn't matter. And in fact, there's been a lot of discussion about this because the Women's Prize, which happened last week, they had a big campaign this year around getting more men to read books by women, because obviously you're very enlightened, but there's a lot of men out there who statistically, or a lot of data shows, there's been a lot of data on book buying and that kind of thing, those sort of demographics, that men will predominantly buy books by other men. And in fact, it was interesting because last week, this Women's Prize campaign also coincided with lots of gift guides around Father's Day. And somebody, you know, I saw a few people on social media commenting that, you know, most of the Father's Day book related gift guides were all recommending books by other men. So, and I've certainly noticed that when I do book festivals, the audiences for the historical series are pretty much 50-50, men and women. And when I do the books, the more contemporary ones, they tend to be almost overwhelmingly women. And that might just be because of the content, but I think also it does, you know, I think just instinctively, a lot of men will, you know, pick up a book that looks as if it's a bit more kind of masculine or a bit more manly. And I think with these books, they've designed them very well to kind of try and appeal across the board. So
there is nothing manly about reading. That's what men have to realize. They're already feminized by even picking up a book at all of any kind, even Andy McNab. So no, that's do any of the men walk out when they sit and shout at you when they realize you're not a sort of bespectacled old historian man, as well, they may be imagining.
They haven't walked out. Now, usually they're quite pleasantly surprised, although I was at Hay recently and there was a guy in the audience who said, and this did surprise me because I've written six of these books now, and there's always been a picture of me on the cover. It's never been a secret that it's a pseudonym. So So this guy was in the audience and he piped up at the end and said, you know, I've read all of your books and I had no idea until today that you were a woman. And I'm hoping that he hadn't met me in the past. But no, I asked him how that could be. And he said, well, because I read on a Kindle. So on a Kindle, you don't get the jacket. You don't really see, you're not looking at the author's name every time you pick it up. And it just hadn't sort of occurred to him to do any kind of, you know, biographical digging. So I thought that's interesting because obviously Kindles do change the way we relate to a book. I hadn't realized that was, you know, that was still possible, but
So let's talk about the new book Storm. Again, when we're talking about novels and thrillers with lots of twists and stuff, and I'm obviously it's important not to give away too much of what's going to happen, which makes it a little bit harder to talk about. But how do you sort of pitch and describe this book?
Well, I kind of like the term psychological suspense, which is it's not a classic murder mystery. There is a murder in it. And the nature of the murder is, you know, I hope kind of hidden until quite late in the book. So it's a kind of a murder mystery in that sense. But I suppose my model for this book and the one that I did as myself that preceded it, I've always loved Ruth Rendell's Barbara Vine novels. And they're kind of what I would call psychological suspense. And what she does with those is to sort of flip the idea of a detective story. So you're not with the policeman or woman who is trying to solve the crime, you are with the people who are in the midst of the crime. So, you know, either people who have committed a crime and are trying to cover it up, or people who have been accused of a crime or are in some way associated with it. So the police are kind of on the other side, and you're there, you know, in the midst of a group of people, in the case of Storm, a group of old university friends who've gone away for a weekend anniversary house party in France. And then an unexpected guest turns up and it starts to bring to the surface secrets and lies that have been buried among this group for the last 20 years. So that's sort of the idea of it.
And they're quite, and even the character we're sort of following, Joe, is quite a flawed and not particular. I mean, out of all of them, she's a bit more likable than most of them, but of the older generation anyway. But she's not particularly likable or morally. Well, she's a bit morally ambiguous, I suppose, with everything else they go on, which is quite interesting to have a sort of protagonist that we can't fully get behind. I like it.
Yeah, I mean, I think my editors were concerned about that. And it is one of those questions that comes up about, you know, how much do you have to like the protagonist of a book in order to be rooting for them, or of a drama? You know, you think about something like Breaking Bad, and, you know, Walter White does some morally terrible things, and yet we are kind of on his side because we've been following him. And I wanted that with this group of people. I mean, they are all extremely flawed, and yet they are people who kind of in their public life, they've all got sort of relatively high status jobs, and they're people who in their public life would be seen to be, certainly by the right wing press, as kind of do-gooders. You know, there's a kind of, there's a human rights lawyer, there's a TV producer who makes dramas about the underclass, and then there's a kind of AI tech billionaire, and a lefty liberal journalist. So they're all people who would be seen as kind of doing, you know, doing good in the world or believing themselves to do good. And yet they've got these kind of deep moral flaws in their own characters and things that they have covered up and lied about. And Joe, I was interested in writing about somebody who is in, she's kind of still in the shadow of grief. She's lost her husband. That's not a spoiler. She was, you know, widowed before the book starts. And it's a year after the death of her husband that she goes away with his old group of friends on this holiday. And she's still grieving. So she's somebody who is kind of, she's not got a huge amount of kind of impetus or get up and go. She's still in the really quite sort of sunk in her grief, which was something that interested me. And she is also someone who has perhaps put aside her own qualms and doubts about this group of people because she likes the perks of kind of being involved in that group. And I just like the idea of writing a heroine, in particular a woman who's not necessarily, she doesn't necessarily live up to the sort of the idea of, you know, how women should behave or this idea of being likable. She is a kind of prickly character. And yeah. Yet I do have great sympathy for her because I think she's somebody who has been, as the book goes on, it's revealed she's been in a relationship that was quite controlling, but in a way that was so subtle she wasn't even maybe aware of it herself, mm-hmm. You know, that she has been kind of stifled in this marriage and has put up with all sorts of things that she probably shouldn't have. So, yeah, I think it's a good question. There's been a lot of debate in recent years about whether, because it's a question that's not often asked about male characters, you know, about whether they should be likable. I think she is sympathetic, but then, you know, I hope that other people will find...
I mean, she is. But it just, you know, it veers between, because also, obviously, a storm, the younger character who comes in and causes the storm, it's very clever what you've done there, is pretty likable, but of course, you know, everyone's suspicious about what's going on, and as a reader, you're wondering what's going on. She seems very friendly, but there's clearly something happening going on there. So, and Jo is sort of vacillating between the different groups, isn't she? Sort of almost changing allegiances as she goes.
I mean, she likes so. Let me tell you about a bit about. Oops, sorry. I'm just going to close that window. Let me just tell you a bit about Storm, about where that came from, because that was inspired by not the plot, but the idea of this the arrival of a character into a group of people whose arrival, I suppose, almost like Mary Poppins, kind of causes people to be shaken out of their routine and maybe out of their roles that they've been playing for a long time in that group. And there's a novel, I think it was 2005 it came out, by Ali Smith, called The Accidental. It's not one of her more famous books, but I really love it. And it's about this very dysfunctional family that go on a summer holiday to a not very attractive bit of Norfolk. And on the first day, this very attractive young woman turns up in the house. And this family is so dysfunctional that they all think she must be, they just don't communicate. So they all think she must be something to do with one of the others. So nobody really challenges her. So she just kind of stays. And gradually she is almost like a sort of slightly witchy Mary Poppins figure, because she does start to kind of resolve these tensions. She sort of, with each member of the family, she behaves in a slightly different way and kind of brings, you know, she begins to resolve these tensions that are on these problems that are between them. And I've always loved that book, but I've always thought, what would happen if it was a darker story? If, you know, if this charismatic person who turns up in the middle of a group and everybody kind of likes them and but is also sort of, you know, unsettled by them. What if that person had a kind of malign intent rather than, you know, having come to kind of heal things, had actually come to kind of cause more strife? So that's where that the idea of that came from. I've always liked that idea of a group being sort of thrown into disarray.
Yeah, and there's a few things at play, because obviously there's the age difference. There's a, you know, a very attractive woman coming in and the way that the men and the women react to her. But it's also a lot about class. Even for Jo, she sort of feels like she doesn't fit in particularly with her, which is a weird, you know, it's a weird thing for her. She is a sort of outsider. That's a weird thing to go back to the group of friends that sort of aren't really your group of friends, that your ex, you know, your dead husband's group of friends.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of, I mean, I think that, I suppose that's very interesting, the way, I mean, it always seems that posh people and rich people come out very badly in fiction, that they're all kind of, fairly, you know, hypocritical and a bit stupid as well, really, generally. I mean, I think there's a bit more to it in this book, but do you think that's a fair portrayal of the rich, or are they actually, they never seem to be happy in anything, if you look at Succession or anything like that.
Yeah.
or The Crown, everyone's really unhappy. These people were not totally unhappy, but they seemed to
I think they are all quite unhappy in their yeah. different ways. I think it's it's interesting. Maybe that is a kind of, maybe there's a sort of slight resentment on the part of people who are writing this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Like, you know, those of us who are writing it, that we want to believe. Well, I suppose it's the same reason people read things like those sort of celebrity magazines. You know, we like the idea, I think we the public like the idea that somebody who appears to have everything is actually not happy, it hasn't made them happy, that they're kind of just as burdened as the rest of us, or just yeah. as jealous or insecure or whatever it might be. I think there's something very appealing about showing people who appear to have everything, because part of it is you can do that sort of lifestyle porn thing where you show, as in Succession, you know, or you describe their beautiful houses. And I think we all love the idea of a glimpse into that, the world of the 1%. But I think there is certainly also some truth in the idea that being in a position of influence and a position of power can corrupt. Obviously, it doesn't happen to everybody, but it can corrupt certainly your sense of values, your sense of what you're entitled to or what you can get away with. And I mean, as we have seen relentlessly over the past few months, the idea that, you know, there is a certain class of people who believe themselves to be not subject to the rules that everybody else is supposed to abide by, and that if they choose to do something simply by virtue of them having done it, that makes it all right, or it can be justified or excused in some way. So that, I think, is what I wanted to show with this group of friends. You know, they have all come, they haven't all necessarily come from privilege, but they've all ended up by virtue of, you know, talent and patronage and good education, they've all ended up in positions of some privilege in society. Mm-hmm. And Jo, you know, that's partly why I was interested in her perspective and why she's not quite sure where her loyalties lie in this group, because she has always felt like an outsider. She's always kind of felt that she doesn't quite belong in this group. And she's very attracted to this outsider, Storm, who comes in, who also doesn't belong, but has more sort of boldness than Jo has ever had to challenge these people and their values and their the way they treat others. And so there's a kind of admiration for her in that.
No, it's very good. And do you think, is there a little bit of you in Jo? Is that in, you know, you were, I mean, it reminded me of myself being at university and feeling that everybody else was super posh and I'd been allowed in by accident. And I sort of, you know, was overwhelmed by the confidence of all the kind of public school kids. And obviously you've also worked in journalism, so you may have met certain characters that may have been journalists and then gone on to be prime minister. I don't know. But so you've certainly met people who've gone on to be bigger deals as starting in journalism and whatever. So is there a bit of you in there? Is that more closer to you, that character?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, certainly that sense of feeling a bit like an outsider. I think most writers have felt that at one time or another. And yeah, I was aware. I mean, I had a, I didn't have a group of friends like that at university. My friends were actually lovely. But I definitely did meet people like that. And certainly working in the media for years, you do come across these little closed circles of people with immense privilege. And yeah, and feeling, you know, that I don't quite belong here. I'm never going to fit in here. And so I suppose there were aspects of that as well. And an aspect of, you know, I had recently been through a breakup. So I was not, I mean, not a bereavement in that way, but I was kind of in the process of thinking about that a lot. And so I suppose I channeled some of that into the idea of Jo finding herself on her own unexpectedly at that point in her life with a young child. So, yeah, and I, well, part of the appeal for me of writing these contemporary books is that I can write more obviously about the lives of women, which I can't do necessarily in the historical books. I mean, obviously, there were kind of interesting women around in the 16th century, but to write about the concerns of women of my age and my friends and things that I see people I know going through, those kind of issues, it's much obviously much easier to do that with a contemporary book.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I think, again, the older characters who would perceive themselves as being feminist sort of shutting the door basically on this younger and very threateningly beautiful woman. I wonder whether all men are as shallow as to be. I mean, maybe they are. Yeah. I know I am, I'm just wondering whether all men would be as easily beguiled by beauty. Maybe that's true, but it's interesting that the female characters are flawed in that way, that they sort of, I mean, it's very realistic.
Yeah,
as well.
I wanted to write about that because, you know, it's interesting to be, I suppose, kind of in midlife now and to see the way that women in their 40s, you know, there's that kind of looking around the group of people that I know and, you know, for people that I maybe don't know so well, but I follow on social media, there's all those debates about, you know, aging gracefully and naturally, or whether you know, people have a lot of work done and whether that's feminist and all of these questions. And so much of it is to do with, you know, hanging on to that kind of sexual power and what happens when somebody who doesn't have to work for that, somebody who is 22 and gorgeous, kind of comes into the middle of your social circle where you know, all the men in the group are coupled up, but they're obviously, none of these marriages are particularly happy, and so all the wives, you know, that kind of jealousy, that kind of envy of, you know, what you used to be and what somebody else now has effortlessly, because I think that's the thing that, you know, for women you do become very conscious of when you get into your 40s. And when I handed in the first draft of this book, my agent read it and he said, God, but the men are all so awful. And I said, yeah. And so, no, you're right. I'm sure not all, hashtag not all men.
I don't think it'd be as interesting a novel if all the men were going, yes, we'll respect you and it's lovely to see you.
Yeah. Well, and also that is an interesting thing because I didn't, you know, it wasn't particularly written with an eye to kind of making a big point about Me Too, but the men that I'm writing about, they're in their 40s. They are, I suppose, of our kind of generation where they've had to make quite a rapid shift from what was acceptable for, you know, when the guy's 10 years older than them when they started work, the kind of behavior that was acceptable, to what guys 10, you know, 15 years younger would, you know, now consider to be completely out of order. And yeah. So they're that generation that's sort of stuck in the middle where they did, you know, grow up understanding, knowing about feminism, but it was still okay to kind of, there were certain behaviours were still considered, yeah, you know, not as shocking as they are now. So
and for the story and the book, it, you know, it is it makes sense that they that they would behave like they have form, let's say, in terms of behaving that way. So it's, you know, it's, there's obviously an element of justice to it, although do we ever get justice for these kind of things? Which, you know, it's, I very much like the fact that it's there's a lot of ambiguity in this book, and there's a, you know, what happens might not be exactly what your hopes happens, or might be, you know, it might not be fair, or it might not be. So it's you know, it's very true to life, I think, and you kind of you hope that these, most of these guys will get their comeuppance, but whether they will or not is sort of hanging in the air.
Thank you, and thank you for not kind of giving away too much. It is difficult to talk about this stuff, but yeah, but I wanted it, I didn't want it to be all kind of neatly wrapped up where, you know, everybody who has behaved badly gets, you know, it has to pay for it at some point, because that kind of isn't how the world works necessarily. And some of the guys who have a more sensitive conscience have obviously been kind of troubled by that over the years and have been suffering for it in their own ways, but they haven't. Yeah, the idea that kind of justice is all neatly packaged up, because, you know, when you think about it, that isn't, very often isn't how that works, particularly with kind of anything to do with sexual misbehaviour.
And you know, I love that Joe is, you know, has to, you know, make choices as well, and maybe doesn't make the choices she would hope she would make. Mm. So, you know, because the self in, that's why it carries on, isn't it? Because people have to think of that, you know, everyone has to think of their own selfish interests and their own their own lives going ahead, and so you do end up making these massively compromised moral judgments.
Well, yeah, and I think a lot of that is to do with I certainly wanted it in the book to be to do with people making choices about how something will affect their children, because I think there's perhaps we're a bit more understanding in a sense of, you know, somebody doing something for a purely selfish reason, for selfish gain, and somebody making a choice that perhaps we might not necessarily agree with because it is a way of protecting their child. And I think we could all, you know, I like the idea of trying to think myself into that, into that mindset. You know, how far would I be prepared to go to protect, you know, my child if I was put into that position. And I think, you know, that's something we've all kind of had to think about.
It's a thing that I was left thinking about it for a long, you know, you're thinking about it days later, which is always great with a book. And it's really terrific. It's very gripping. You know, you can't really second guess it. I was trying to second guess it and I didn't second guess it. So, well, not entirely. So it's, you know, it's a lot of fun, and it's, and the characters are terrific.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Did you go to France to research this book? Was that part of the jolly of it, that you got to go out and drink lots of wine?
Well, I would have loved to, but I was writing this in the middle of all the lockdowns, which So I had planned to. So it's based on a real place that I visited with my son when he was four. So that's right. 16 years ago. Although I have to, every time I say this, I have to make very clear that these terrible people who own the chateau are not based on the real owners, who are lovely, who are currently listening to the book on audio. I think they like it. It is a real place. It's kind of in the Bordeaux region, this beautiful chateau that was bought and kind of done up by an English couple. And I stayed there, and I liked the idea of it being somewhere that's it's a bit remote. Everybody's been sort of taken out of their everyday life. So you can't just kind of hop on a train back to London. You know, they're in a different jurisdiction, so they're not quite sure what is, what's expected of them. In terms of what they're allowed to, I'm trying not to give too much away, but in terms of, they've got to deal with the French police at some point, but they, they're outside of their everyday lives. And so I did do a lot of, fortunately, Google Street Map is absolutely brilliant. So I did a lot of places that I had visited before. I was able to just go on Google Maps and kind of walk down those streets with the little camera all the way through lockdown. So I will go back and visit at some point. But it was a nice way as well of, while I was stuck in my house in Surrey, being able to kind of imagine myself back into a French vineyard.
Yeah, very nice. And it feels, when you write, it feels like it could be a film. Is that something that when you're writing a book like this, are you thinking, right, well, let's set this in a beautiful estate home with a very pretty young woman in it? And, there's a lot of action really as well in various locations. A lot of drama. So it feels like it could be very filmic. Is that something that you think about when you're writing a novel, or are you concentrating on that and not thinking about advances you can get to?
It depends, really. No, I think certainly with the contemporary ones, there is, I suppose, there's always now one eye on the kind of potential TV series. And there is, as we said before, there is an appetite, I think, for stories about lives of the rich and famous, and where you can, one of the things we love about Succession is that you get to look inside all these kind of extraordinary houses that most of us would never have access to. So there is a bit of that. So I wanted it to be kind of visually attractive. And then, I wanted, all the characters are kind of meant to be good looking as well. And you've got this very charismatic kind of, but I think there's some good female parts in it as well. So hopefully if somebody would like to turn that into a series, I'd be delighted. I suppose it is a bit more, I've got a bit more of a sense of kind of dramatizing it with these books, because when I do the historical series, they're all written in the first person. So you're much more inside one character's head, which is harder, I think, to adapt that for the screen. Whereas with these ones, you've got a couple of different points of view and you can kind of shift the perspective a bit more. So I suppose it's got a slightly more of a dramatic potential in that way.
Yeah, although I feel the historical ones, I haven't read all of those, but I have read a couple of those. I feel they are, that would surely be.
Oh, they are crying out for a series,
adaptation. No. Go for a movie, Stephanie. Don't settle for TV. Although TV's the big...
TV's where it's at now, because you can make something over several hours rather than just 90 minutes.
Exactly. And what's your writing? What's as a novelist? I mean, you're obviously still doing some journalism. Do you work all day on a novel? Do you sort of concentrate on a novel and then move on to other stuff? Are you, is it sort of a 9-to-5, or are you picking up hours here and there?
No, I mean, I've refined this system over many years, and I still don't think I've really nailed, but, I have figured out over the years that, I do my best creative writing in the morning. So what I have to try and do is, not look at any social media. I try and get to my desk by 8 o'clock. I try to work 8 till 12 without getting distracted by emails and phone calls and things. And obviously that's much easier because I've got an empty house now. So my son's gone off to university. So that's much easier now that I don't have somebody else in the house, or, when he was smaller and I had to get him to school, it wasn't quite so straightforward. But so now I try and work in the morning, and I generally find if I can get a couple of thousand words done in the morning, then that's about all my brain's got space for. So, on a good day, I can do a couple of thousand words in, you know, that's in good. A good so morning's work. And then, yeah, and then in the afternoon, I just sort of fanny around on Twitter and, you know, that sort of thing.
And how much preparation is the book like? Have you worked everything out before you start it, or are you someone who likes to be surprised by it? It feels like so intricate, this one, that you must have had a lot of this.
Yeah, planned. Definitely with this one, I wrote the first draft without really, I had a vague kind of notion of the outline of the plot, but I wrote it without really having mapped it out at all and without figuring out quite how it was going to end. Which I think probably showed in the first draft. So I had to, there was quite a lot of rewriting to do with that. So I then kind of came back to it and rewrote. And at that point I had to figure out where the kind of, you know, how to build up the suspense a bit more. Cause I think that was missing in the first one. I just sort of wrote it straight through. But with the historical, because they're more sort of obviously detective stories, I do plan those a bit more thoroughly than I do with these ones. So I sort of work out, you know, I always have to start with who's going to get murdered and why, and then work out how many other red herrings I can throw in, you know, before people kind of get wise to who done it. So
I mean, that is so difficult, right? Because especially, I mean, the people who read these kind of books, like read a lot of books like this, I'm imagining that they get. So it must be, that's what I've always, when something has a twist in that you're not expecting or a plot that surprises you, it's quite impressive to achieve that sleight of hand, I think, when so many thriller books exist.
Yeah. And, you know, crime readers are really smart. You know, they like you say, get some people who love that genre will have read a ton of crime novels. And so you know, the obvious twists, or you've really got to steer clear of those, because you just don't want, there's nothing more disappointing than kind of guessing what's going to happen early on in a book. And so sometimes I have, I've got kind of three quarters of the way through a book and realized that I've made it too obvious. And so I've done a little switcheroo where I've actually changed the person who I thought was going to be the murderer. I've actually thought, no, let's not have that person. Let's change it. So I have done that with some of the historical ones, just to try and kind of keep people guessing. And I've got a brilliant, brilliant editor at HarperCollins who she's been editing crime books for a long time, and she's worked with people like Colin Dexter and Val McDermott and, you know, all the big names. So I always feel if I can get a plot twist past her without her spotting it too early, then I feel like I've won. So she, you know, cause she's so well versed in this stuff. So, so it's often a question of kind of deciding who you think, how you think it's going to go, and then sticking an extra twist in right at the end, because, you know, just to try and sort of keep it not too obvious.
I mean, there's twists in this, and then, but then, you know, I like it, it's sort of, you know, there's twists all the way, really, and you sort of think, oh, maybe I listened to the audiobook, so you've got an idea of, you know, you've got less of an idea how long there is left in the book, unless you're looking at how many more minutes it is, so you kind of think, oh, this might be coming to an end. And then there was, you know, that there was a lot more and some more surprises to come after that bit. So it is, you know, it's great for that. I've enjoyed that. And with the audiobook, was there any you know, you've got a lovely speaking voice, was there any, were you put off by the idea of having to do an Irish accent, or would you never
I probably I am actually legally an Irish citizen now, so don't know whether I'm allowed to. No, I think it's still I don't know whether that would count as cultural appropriation. It probably would. I've never been asked to do my own audiobooks, and I think it's just because there's so many different characters, I think it just makes more sense to get, you know, professional actors to do it. And
I think it probably does in this case. And it's I love hearing the author read it, but I think there is sometimes an author reads it and they're, you know, and you kind of notice some speech impediment or something that is just in the back, and just notice something that really starts getting on your nerves. So she is Victoria Fox reads this one, and she's very, you know, she does get all the characters very lightly as well. It's not like it's not overplayed in terms of getting the characterization, but you absolutely 100% know who's talking.
I think that's such a skill to do that with kind of radio drama or audio drama. It's and it's a skill that I don't have. If I was just reading a memoir, I suppose it would be different. But it's different. So I think you need someone who's properly trained.
And I did find it, again, sometimes an audiobook of a novel can be, you know, you can get distracted or it's difficult to follow. But it does work really well as an audiobook as well for people who, I prefer the audiobooks just in terms of I can do my reading when I'm doing, you know, other stuff. So it means especially for this podcast, I can get a book a week done, which I don't know I could do if I was having to sit down in my spare time and read them. But I do have the book.
So do you read? Do you listen while you're kind of out for walks or in the car?
Yeah, so like if I'm driving into London, that's like an hour there, an hour back. So you can get sort of a quarter way into a book, you know, in two sittings. Yeah. And if I walk the dog for an hour or I go for a run for 45 minutes or whatever, then I think running's actually my best, because often I sort of miss just having a walk with no noise, because you, again, just in terms of coming up with your own ideas, writing your own stuff, it's kind of nice. But then I still do sometimes have an audiobook on, and then that's, you know, makes me think about something else, and suddenly I go, oh, I'm going to have to rewind this and work out where I was because I've not listened for 5 minutes as a result.
Yeah, that's my problem with audio stuff, is that I just get distracted. So,
But I found this one, you know, this one, I don't think it was, I didn't have to rewind it at all. There was no, it was properly gripping. It does feel like, and I guess that's again, it makes it feel slightly like it's got the structure of a drama. If it works as a radio thing in itself, then it's you know, probably, you know, that TV series can't be far away. Well, do you find the having worked as a literary editor, you've obviously done a lot of reviewing and writing about books, does that make it harder to write your own books as well? Does that make it easier? Have you learnt a lot from the mistakes of others and the successes of others, or was it always something that was the plan when you were mainly a journalist?
I started literary journalism because I wanted to write books, but I, you know, that's very few people can kind of do that straight out of university. And also, I don't actually think it's probably not great for you to do that straight out of university, because you need a bit of life experience and you need to be out in the world and meet people, I think, just to in other ways. Otherwise, your second novel is about a person writing a novel, which nobody wants. So I started doing the journalism as a kind of as a day job while I was writing in the evenings. And I think, you know, I'd like to think I've been incredibly fortunate with, you know, the authors that I've interviewed over the years and the authors that I've got to review. You can't help but learn from it and learn, you know, and which is not to say that sometimes critics make the worst novelists, you know, when you actually try to do. And it's also in literary journalism, it's one of those few art forms where the critics very often will, you know, be writing their own books. You know, you don't very often get opera critics who then decide to kind of take to the stage or in you know, in other
or comedy critics. You know, comedy critics usually do it once and go, I'll do a write an article about trying to be a comedian, and then they can't do it. Although I think Fern Brady started trying it for an article, but she turned out to be extremely good.
Exactly. So I think it's one of the, usually in an art form, you sort of have a healthy respect for the fact that you can't actually do it yourself. But a lot of literary critics are also writers, and I hope that, you know, I like to think that I can spot when I've come up with a really clunky metaphor and, you know, and take it out. And and, you know, if I'm overwriting, that's certainly a kind of a failing of most first novelists, and I hope that I'm kind of getting better at weeding that stuff out as I go along.
And is it, as an author now, are you at the position where your publishers are saying, where's your next book, we'll take it? Or are you still having to pitch? Are they coming and say, we want three more of this series?
No, they do. With the historical series, because that's sold very well, I do tend to get three book contracts. Right. So that's nice. So, you know, I sort of know that that I've got work up until, you know, 2025 or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
Which is nice in a way. It's you know, that, but I have enjoyed being able to do these two different, have two different strands of it, because, you know, I think doing too much of the same thing does sort of stifle you a bit creatively. But at the same time, you know, to be able to do this and make a living at it is it's a great stroke of luck, really. That's how I keep thinking about it. You know, I think it is it's a great privilege to be able to do that. So yeah, and it's really nice that people like the series enough to make that a possibility. So yeah, I just keep going with it.
Good. Well, I'm delighted you are, and I really recommend it. It's a really terrific novel. This is Storm. Are you reading anything else, or have you read anything recently that you would think would be worth recommending to people?
Oh, what have I read recently? I've read a few things for review that. Let me tell you, what can I tell you about? So there's a book that is coming out in, it's not out till September, but by an author called Erin Kelly, called The Skeleton Key. And she, again, writes these fantastic psychological suspense books, which are, I suppose, in quite a similar vein. And this one is about, it's about an author who wrote a kind of treasure hunt book back in the 70s, which became a huge kind of cult phenomenon. And then it's about kind of what the legacy of that and what happens to his children and grandchildren when there are still these obsessive fans out there trying to solve the puzzle. It's based on a real book.
Is it based on Masquerade? It sounds
yes,
like.
That's the one. That's why I couldn't remember the title. Yeah, so it's based on that.
I'm in 100% book. For that book. That sounds
It's wonderful. So
you've sold it to me.
She's such a terrific writer. So that's out in September. What else can I tell you about? There was a novel that was shortlisted for the Women's Prize last week, but it didn't win, but I think it should have done, called Great Circle by an American writer called Maggie Shipstead, which is about a female aviator in the 1920s in America. So that's a really brilliant historical novel too.
Cool. Do you mainly read novels, or is that what your interest lies as a reader, or do you branch out into?
No,
obviously
I do.
With the history, you've got to do your historical research.
Yeah, I do read quite a bit of nonfiction as well. You know, just kind of depends what I get. You know, what I'm asked to review, what I've got to read for research, and you know, I sort of try to keep up with current affairs. But there's not. I'll tell you what's on my to be read pile. That is a nonfiction, which is one of my Guardian colleagues, Jonathan Friedland, who also writes thrillers under a pseudonym. But he's got this new book called The Escape Artist, which is it's just come out about a week ago, I think. And it's the story of the first Jewish prisoner to escape from Auschwitz. And it's brilliant. It's been on Radio 4 recently as Book of the Week. And I've read some extracts from it. So that is, I'm waiting to get stuck into that as well.
Terrific. Good. Well, look, everyone should buy your book, Storm, and go back and buy your many. I mean, there's too many to mention. What's this? Is it Heresy?
Heresy's the first one of the historical series. Yeah.
So they should start. Yeah, do you have to read those in order?
No, you don't. I mean, there is a kind of narrative that goes through, but each one is its own self-contained mystery. So you can pick up, you know, you can pick up the most recent one, which is Execution, and you can start with that. So each of them, you know, it doesn't really matter if you've read the previous ones, there's no spoilers. So
you're doing some more of those. Have you got an idea for another novel outside of the series? Is there anything else? Or
for the moment, waiting? I've got two more of the historical ones under contract. So I've got to do those over the next couple of years. In fact, I'm hopefully finishing the seventh Bruno novel by the end of this summer. And that will come out next year. And then I've got a couple of other ideas up my sleeve for what comes next. So, yeah.
Good. Oh, well, I'm so glad you're doing so well. And it's, absolutely love to see you again. Thank you very much to Stephanie Merritt. Thank you also to Chris Evans, not that one, for producing and directing. I think next week's guest is going to be Laura Lex talking about her netball-based book,
great.
Pivot, which I've started reading. It's a bit different than Storm, but it's it's very funny. So, yes, I'll look forward to that. Thank you very much, Stephanie.
Thank you.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
On Formative, middle school kids from New York City public schools interview a phenomenal collection of grown-ups.
Me, like, I don't know what I want to do.
You don't have to have all the answers.
I feel like a lot of people's favorite topics are, like, interest in their life.
That is a really good answer.
The podcast where the leaders of today are interviewed by leaders of tomorrow. Listen now at newyorkedge.org/formative or wherever you get your podcasts.
Thanks very much for listening to the podcast. Go to GoFasterStripe.com for fantastic downloads and books, and to join the Go Faster Stripe Club and get loads of stuff from really interesting comedians. Help little Chris Evans knock that one out. That would be lovely. All right, RichardHerring.com for all my gigs. Hope to see you at a gig. Come and say hi after if you've enjoyed these podcasts. Don't come if you haven't enjoyed them and say you haven't enjoyed them. It will make me feel sad.